Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta, 2 hours ahead of us, talking about the things that matter most. We also today take a look at where things are going right, a new feature that we're instituting here, where we take a look at creative forms of outreach, of gathering together, and we see the Catholic faith lived out with dynamism and believability. So we're going to be talking today about the Institute of Catholic Culture, which has been doing a great job over the last few years. We'll let you know about that with Father Hezekias Carnazzo. We'll have a summary of their work. Also, we're going to be taking a look at the land of Turkey, reliving the glory and gory days of jihad. Raymond Ibrahimov was joining us. Remember, Turkey was once a great Christian region. A large chunk of St. Paul's epistles were sent to or dealt with churches in the area of Turkey. St. John's letters to the seven churches in the first chapters of the book of Revelation are writing to churches largely in the area of Turkey. We're going to ask what's happened over the history there for the gospel and for the spread of the Christian faith. Also today, we'll talk with Stephen Gradanas about films that we can see this Christmas and what films we ought to avoid. There's a new film out called The Two Popes, which imagines a conversation between Pope Emeritus Benedict, played by Anthony Hopkins, and Pope Francis, played by, I think it's Jonathan Pryce. What did Stephen think of it? We're also going to hear about a new film looking at the life of Franz Jagerstatter, a Catholic who died rather than serve with the Nazis and whose cause is being considered. Also, we'll go to Peter Jesserer Smith, who's been doing research into problems in Buffalo and Boston regarding sexual abuse. And I'll have a few comments on Tiger Woods and the glory of the gospel. But first, the headlines.
Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, December 3rd. It's the memorial of St. Francis Xavier. And today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile. More information on December specials at charitymobile.com. California Senator Kamala Harris is notifying her staff that she's dropping out of the Democratic race for president. The one-time prosecutor told staff on a conference call that she will release a video soon with the announcement. Harris's campaign was struggling to raise money and rise in the polls of a crowded field. The Pennsylvania Senate is debating a bill that would require a burial or cremation of human remains after miscarriage or abortion. The bill sponsor, Republican Frank Ryan, said that we've wanted to craft something that was voluntary, that provided the family with the ability for closure, the ability to understand that human life was lost. Governor Tom Wolf, a Democrat, has said he would veto the bill if it makes it to his desk. In November, Wolf vetoed a bill that would have banned abortion of children prenatally diagnosed with Down syndrome. He also vetoed in 2017 a bill that would have limited abortions to 20 weeks into pregnancy and banned dilation and evacuation abortions. Similar bills regarding the treatment of fetal remains are being considered in Ohio and on the federal level. The House Intelligence Committee has released its final report on impeachment. The report from a Democratic-led panel says President Trump placed his own personal and political interest above the national interest of the U.S. It alleges that Trump undermined national security in favor of politically motivated investigations aimed at helping his re-election campaign. An earlier report from Republicans on the committee absolved Trump of wrongdoing. And the President and First Lady Melania Trump are having tea with Prince Charles and his wife in London. That will be followed by a reception with Queen Elizabeth at Buckingham Palace. The President is in London for NATO's 70th anniversary summit. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will host a reception for NATO leaders later today. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. You know, we just passed the 10-year anniversary of Tiger Woods' fall from grace. He was, of course, in the eyes of the world, he was restored to his greatness this year when he won his first major tournament in 11 years. He won the 2019 Masters. But the story of Tiger Woods is there are many aspects to it that I think are fascinating. This was a man who dominated golf like nobody had before. I mean, we can talk about Sam Snead or Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, but really Tiger Woods was in a class by himself. He was the first sportsman to earn over $1 billion. And among African Americans, only Oprah had topped Tiger when it came to net worth. He married this beautiful Swedish model who, in 4 years of marriage, bore him 2 children. But all of that human greatness wasn't enough to hold that tiger. And then on November of 2009, we learned that Woods had been a philandering, unfaithful husband. Several women came forward, and it was a tragic dismantling of what had been a really well-crafted image. He quickly went into a 45-day therapy program. He was divorced, fell to number 58 as a golfer. I mean, that is a bad fall. You know, years before, he had said, "I believe in Buddhism, not every aspect of it, but most of it. So I take bits and pieces. I don't believe," he said, "that human beings can achieve ultimate enlightenment because humans have flaws." So, you know, Tiger Woods did realize that human beings fall short of all they were created to be. But there's a little sub-story here that I thought, from a Christian point of view, also made sense. And that is on January 10th, about a month and a half after all the bad news broke about Tiger Woods, Britt Hume, the political analyst and former reporter, said on Fox News Sunday that Woods would probably be able to recover as a golfer, but, quote, "the extent to which he can recover as a person seems to me to depend on his faith. He's said to be a Buddhist, and I don't think that faith offers the kind of forgiveness and redemption that is offered within the Christian faith." So Hume made an appeal. "Tiger, turn to the Christian faith and you can make a total recovery and be a great example to the world." Now, you don't hear this kind of thing happen, you know, on secular news programs very often, so that's why I remembered it. Of course, obviously, Buddhists weren't happy about that. I understand. But what's funny is that the so-called non-judgmental mainstream press that didn't have a dog in this fight turned out as catty as you can ever, as anybody. I mean, they thought Hume, you'd get the impression that Hume had threatened to forcibly baptize Tiger's children. He, you know, Britt Hume's appeal to Tiger to come to Christ was called ridiculous, denigrating, arrogant bluster, proselytization. Apparently, Britt Hume had become a genuine threat to the stability of the Republic. Interesting. Unsatisfied, of course, with secularized government, the press apparently expects Christians to secularize their own political discussions. Look, does Christianity have resources that Buddhism doesn't? Well, yes. I mean, as a Christian who knows Christ's claim on our lives, yes, you can't avoid saying that. This is not to deny that Buddhism has certain aspects of truth to it, but the real question always has to be, was Brit Hume right in saying that the Christian faith has the kind of grace that allows for repentance and redemption that Buddhism doesn't offer? Well, if you were to ask a Buddhist about this, they would say clearly Christianity offers something different than what Buddhism offers. Now, that doesn't mean they accept the truth of the Christian faith. It simply means they understand there is a major difference here. I mean, the one place where Christianity and Buddhism actually come somewhat close together is simply on the recognition of how pervasive is human suffering. That's a key insight of Buddha. And, of course, Christians who understand that the suffering of this world and the sin of this world cost God his own son. So suffering is at the heart of our understanding of what reality is. But, you know, John Paul II had written on this. I mean, he said, the doctrines of salvation in Buddhism and Christianity are opposed. Carmelite mysticism begins at the point where the reflections of Buddha end. He wrote this in Crossing the Threshold of Hope. So, you know, Hume's theological instincts were right. It's not a put-down. It's making it very clear that there are different offers. And as John Paul II said, the doctrines of salvation in Buddhism and Christianity are opposed. They teach a very different way of union with God. And then he went on to say, Carmelite mysticism begins at the point where the reflections of Buddha end. So, I mean, let me clarify a little more. I mean, Christianity offers forgiveness from sin, and through that, it offers union with an infinite personal God who is love, a God who created a good world that we are supposed to steward and develop. Buddhism, on the other hand, offers an impersonal nirvana, gained after repeated reincarnations. You are to seek perfect detachment from the world because your attachment to the world is what produces suffering and evil. So the Christian experiences forgiveness, redemption, and union. The Buddhist experiences karma, reincarnation, and the self's absorption into ultimate being. Even comparative religion scholar Stephen Prothero snidely agreed with Hume. He said, you know, you have the law of karma, so Woods is going to have to pay for whatever wrongs he's done. There's no accountant in the sky wiping sins off your balance sheet like there is in Christianity. In Asian religious philosophy, karmic doctrine, karma, really puts together, that's the one thing that really flows through Buddhism and Hinduism and Jainism and Sikhism and Taoism. It'd be no exaggeration to say that the one concept which distinguishes Indian philosophy from European philosophy is the concept of karma. So karma is that iron law of the universe which teaches that what you sow is what you reap. This is an ironclad law. There's no grace that can set aside one's misdeeds, one's sin. This is a perfect justice, you might say, that what you sow is what you reap. That proverbial statement of Jesus, what you sow is what you reap, is turned in Asian philosophy, is turned into an ironclad law of the universe. And that's quite different than the way Jesus uses the phrase, what you sow is what you reap. Because within Christianity, we also know that because of God's grace, we end up able to reap a lot more good than we could ever sow. But that's not true in Asian religious philosophy, especially Hinduism and Buddhism. And, you know, this is a little far away from Tiger Woods, but my point is that there is a very different view of God, a different view of salvation, a different view of a savior, and a different view of our responsibility between Hinduism, Buddhism, and Christianity. For instance, reincarnation, karma demands reincarnation. So this iron law of karma means what you sow is what you reap. Since you end up sowing a lot of bad karma, right? You know, because we all fall short of perfection, so you're going to always be reaping misdeeds. Then you have to come back in another incarnation, right? You have to be born again to come back into another human body in order to kind of offset that karma. And Catholic Church teaches, the scriptures teach, historic Christianity teaches that it's appointed unto man once to die and then the judgment. There's no reincarnation within historic Christianity. The Catechism of the Catholic Church puts it this way. Death is the end of man's earthly pilgrimage. It's the end of the time of grace and mercy which God offers him so as to work out in his earthly life his ultimate destiny. When the single course of our earthly life is completed, we shall not return to other lives. It is appointed unto man to die once. There is no reincarnation after death. Again, Catechism of the Catholic Church there. Within Christianity, our destiny is resurrection, not reincarnation. And these two, just on the level of idea, these two things are clearly opposed. In Christ, God demonstrates to us that he is most intimately involved and aware of our sufferings. Christ submitted himself. Think about this. God isn't, you know, some abstract entity watching us as we sow misdeeds and then reap misdeeds and then go through the process of reincarnation to try to work off our bad karma. No, God enters human experience. Christ submits himself to the same historical process of suffering and victimization that we all endure. He also vindicates the worthiness of this process by rising from the dead and showing us that all the suffering is ultimately worth it. You know, all the painful toil of this world will have been fruitful for those who are in Christ Jesus. This, again, is a very different gospel than the gospel of Buddhism. So, Brit Hume, for all of the attacks that he underwent for offering repentance and forgiveness to Tiger Woods, Brit Hume was on the money. And on this, you know, 10 years since the fall of Tiger Woods, we're glad to see him back in golf, but the offer of repentance remains.
Bishop Robert Barron.
Find out, in any cultural situation, who's the Lord? There's somebody or some principle, some figure, some institution that has central importance in that culture. Whether it's king, whether it's the military, who knows what it is? Go up and down the centuries. What's the Lord? The declaration of the Lordship of Jesus will always be a challenge to whatever that reigning Lord happens to be. The Lord today is my personal freedom. I decide what my life is. I decide who I am. I decide everything from my gender to the ultimate meaning of my life. Now that personal freedom is so powerful that it's become the Lord. To evangelize the culture is therefore to challenge them and to say, no, it's not your own ego, not your own freedom that's Lord. Jesus determines the meaning of your life. Jesus is the center of your life, not your own freedom.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John, chapter 8, verse 51. Jesus is in a discussion with some of the leaders of the Jews. They're talking about Abraham. Abraham lived 1,500 years before the time of Jesus. So in the course of the discussion, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." He says that often in the Gospels. "He who keeps my word or believes in me will never die." To which the Jews say, "Now we know you have a demon." And they say, "Abraham died, as did the prophets. All the patriarchs, the great men and women of the history of Israel. All these people died, and you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death? Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died? And the prophets, who died?" And Jesus says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced that he was to see my day. He saw it and was glad. To which the Jews say, you are not yet 50 years old, and you've seen Abraham? And Jesus answers, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am.
Is it impossible to live Jesus Christ's command that the marriage bond be indissoluble? No, says the Catholic Catechism. The Lord has not placed too heavy a burden on the shoulders of a married couple. By coming to restore the order of creation disturbed by sin, Christ himself gives the strength and grace to live marriage in the new dimension of the reign of God. By following Christ, renouncing themselves, and taking up their crosses, spouses will be able to receive the original meaning of marriage and live it with the help of Christ. St. Paul, in a letter to the Ephesians, emphasizes this when he admonishes men to love their wives as Christ loved the church. For this reason, Paul says, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at avemariaradio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to avemariaradio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at solidarityhealthshare.org or at 844-313-4999.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We continue our new series where we feature somewhere in the Catholic world where things really are going right. And talking today with Father Hezekias Carnasso. He is the founding executive director of the Institute of Catholic Culture. He was ordained to the priesthood on May 1st of 2016 and is also the recipient of the Guadalupe Radio Network's Fishers of Men Award and the Brent Society's Bishop Thomas J. Welsh Award for Distinguished Service. You can follow his work at theinstituteofcatholicculture.org. And Father, it's good to have you back here. Thanks.
Hi, Al. How are you doing? It's good to be with you.
Yeah, no, I'm doing well. And we're really very pleased that you're continuing to flourish there at the Institute of Catholic Culture. It's an adult catechetical organization. Talk to us a little bit about how it came about.
Well, you know, Al, I'm a graduate from Christendom College out in Front Royal, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was there, also a revert to the faith, by the way, I was away from Christ, away from the church. And I discovered there at Christendom a wonderful education and kind of the breadth of the beauty, the depth of our faith. And I also discovered there how many people just haven't learned the faith in an adult manner.
Right.
In our church, so many people lack a deep understanding of history, of theology, philosophy, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, we can't really live out our faith as we should. And so many people are hungry. We want more. And so I founded the Institute to kind of answer that need and give people a chance really to have a taste of a deep experience, a deep knowledge of the faith, of our history, of our philosophy, and so forth. And the results have been just amazing, the response of changed lives. When we come to know Christ, we come to know who we're made for and what we're made for. And so through this experience of learning the faith together, so many lives have been changed and come to a deep personal encounter with Jesus Christ.
Tell us a little bit about how you established the lecture series there. I mean, you've really gathered a tremendous amount of material. And it's outstanding. Tell us how you went about that.
Well, it started at a local parish in Northern Virginia, St. John the Beloved, McLean, Virginia. And there we started holding Bible studies, history studies, philosophy studies there. And it just grew almost immediately from 20 people to 60 people regularly meeting together. And we began offering our programs online via webinar. Everything is done live. Live courses, and then of course we kind of sock that away in our library. We got over 1,000 hours now of free education in our library, but it just grew like that beyond Northern Virginia, now beyond the United States. We have open registration right now for our History 101 course, which is a semester long course. We have 1,000 registrants, and we still have 2 more weeks of open registration for it from I think 20-30 countries. Every state in the United States participating, amazing. We started small. It was very much kind of a grassroots, organic work, but just grew. And I'll tell you why, Chris, the number one thing is that we've been faithful to Christ, faithful to the teachings of the church. And you know as well as I do, the places where it's going right in the church is where we are being faithful to the tradition that has been handed down to us.
Yes. It is. It's amazing to see that, because it is what you would hope, but that where people are being faithful to the teaching of the church, you are seeing the faith flourishing.
Yeah.
So you have a wide range of course offerings. So do people, how do they actually, quote, attend to these classes?
Sure. Well, number one is our website, instituteofcatholicculture.org, instituteofcatholicculture.org. And people can come there, see the offerings that we have coming up live, to register to participate in those via webinars. So no matter where you are in the United States or beyond, you can participate live. And by live, I mean we ask you, the teachers there, and we have a webinar going on. And maybe some of your listeners don't know what a webinar is or think that's too complicated. It is so easy on your computer. Click, and you're in.
Right.
And you can ask the teacher questions. You participate live via your own video, or you can simply watch and post your questions in the chat box, however you want to do it. But the point is that this is really kind of a discipleship model program in which I'm going to learn from solidly Catholic professors, teachers. They're teaching in the seminaries, they're teaching in our good Catholic colleges, and I'm going to be able to ask the questions that I have about the faith and really learn and kind of fill in the knowledge in the areas I might be weak or have questions about, and be guided by a teacher. And that's so important. Real education requires that, this kind of aspect in which I can find someone who can kind of guide me down the path of spiritual growth and encounter with the Lord. In this year in which we're celebrating the canonization of St. John Henry Newman, that famous quote of his, to be deep in history is to cease to be a Protestant.
Right.
I love that, because there's a flip side to that. And that is, and I really believe this, Al, to be deep in history is to be Catholic.
And,
you know, because you begin to see how God has worked through salvation history. And then I begin to realize his working in my own life. I like to use the idea of the fingerprint. If I know salvation history, then I begin to recognize God's fingerprint. And then I can start to see that fingerprint in my life. And that goes through all disciplines, not just history, but philosophy and theology, scripture study, and so forth. That as I grow in the knowledge of the faith, I encounter the one for whom I've been made.
Yes.
And so this knowledge of the faith is critically important. And the breakdown of the communication of the faith, the breakdown of catechesis in our church, is it the foundation of the struggles that we've faced as a church.
I agree.
You know, I'll share with you an image this priest told me one time. He says, you know, Father, he says, I look across the landscape, which is the church, over the past 40, 50 years, and it looks at first glance like a wasteland. I mean, it's you know, convents have emptied and there's problems out there. But then I look closer and it's like the first rain has come and there's a little green shoots coming up everywhere.
Yes.
And he's right, Al. There's so much hope. When you see a program like the Institute of Catholic Culture, some people say, oh, you know, Catholics aren't interested in learning the faith or learning the scriptures. And I say, that's crazy. That we are the ones that love it the most. But if we just have an opportunity to learn in the right manner, and that's what the Institute has offered, you know, wonderful teachers, engaging teachers, which is why, I mean, 1,000 people interested in taking history 101.
Yeah.
You know, but they're, we're hungry. We're hungry as a church.
Now, so tell me, who's teaching the live course right now, the history course?
Well, we're Dr. John Pepino, who's a classics professor at Our Lady of Guadalupe Seminary in Denton, Nebraska, for the Fraternity of St. Peter, is going to be teaching that course for us. But we've got teachers, you know, Monsignor Pope, Father Paul Scalia, Christopher Check from Catholic Answers, and others who are really qualified teachers. Even my brother's teaching for us right now. He has his PhD in New Testament studies. He's teaching a New Testament course, again, semester long. It's been a year long because we started in Genesis, and now we're kind of coming to the conclusion of that in the Book of Revelation. 1,300 people enrolled in that course.
Beautiful.
And, you know, and they're not all semester long. So, you know, some people can't make that kind of a commitment. We have programs, in fact, this evening on authentic liberal arts education and what that means. So one part, two part series that people can plug into and learn the faith. And it really is an opportunity for everyone, no matter where you are, location wise or time wise, you can participate. And not just courses like that. We do each week a study in the gospel for the coming Sunday so that people can really prepare their hearts to engage in the liturgy on Sunday. So there's opportunities regardless of your interest or time commitment. We have something for you.
And what does it cost?
That's the best part, Al. You know, do you ever remember Jesus charging for entrance fee to the Mount of Beatitudes? You know, the Lord has given us freely,
yep.
And so it is the Institute's mission,
yep,
to offer education freely.
Yep.
All of our programs are free of charge, and there's not a gimmick in there. Free of charge. You can take something that you might engage in at seminary or college and do it absolutely free. And I gotta stress the quality. Father Scalia said once, he says, you know, the education you receive in the Institute of Catholic Culture is better than the education received in seminary in Rome.
Yeah, yeah.
And that says something.
It does. And I it's important to keep that in front of people, too, because good teachers are really to be prized, and you've had a wonderful eye for choosing outstanding instructors. So just tell us a little bit more about the particular courses that are people can enroll in at the present moment. You've got the history course, and what else is available?
Yeah, so we've got really lots of opportunities in general in theology, scripture, catechetics, and so forth. So those are key. As I mentioned, we have a course starting this evening on the liberal arts. We also have an opportunity for people to engage in our catechism course with Monsignor Pope, which we just made available. And so many opportunities. We're about to release our next quarter of classes that are all going to be done live starting in January. So again, wonderful opportunities coming up in mid-December here. Monsignor Pope is going to be leading us in a study of the hymn Rerate Caeli, which is an Advent hymn in preparation for the Feast of Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
We have a wonderful program on memory. This is one of my favorites that we have coming up shortly, where we go back, you know, it's a lost art in some ways, the lost art of memory.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's certain things we can do to kind of cultivate the gift of our human nature, this gift that God has given us, the gift of memory. And we're going to be having really a kind of a practical study of how to kind of improve our memory And so that as we engage in the faith and learn the faith, those principles can stick with us across disciplines. So
we're just about out of time. How do people get in touch with you?
InstituteofCatholicCulture.org. InstituteofCatholicCulture.org. InstituteofCatholicCulture.org.
Father, thanks once again. Great talking with you.
It's been a pleasure.
Are you looking for an affordable option for your health care? Do you feel compelled to support pro-life efforts in our country? Then now is the time for you to join CMF Curo. CMF Curo is the country's first healthcare sharing experience that engages church teachings by offering truly pro-life healthcare. CMF Curo members experience healthcare that's ethically consistent with church teachings and rooted in Catholic community. Learn more about CMF Curo and find Catholic healthcare options at mycatholichealthcare.com.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The EWTN home video highlight for December is the EWTN Family Christmas Special. The Choir of the Eternal Word Television Network performs classical Christmas carols with a special commentary by Father Joseph Mary Wolfe. Order your DVD or CD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. The Catholic faith has enemies. We're Catholics. We have enemies. They are a danger to the faith. And yet we're called to defend the faith, to instruct the ignorant, and to love our enemies. These enemies abuse divine revelation. They abuse science and religion. They abuse our history and our past. They abuse power and wealth. We have to learn how to deal with our enemies by picking up a copy of my book, Dangers to the Faith. You can find it online at AveMariaRadio.net.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are committed.
As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
During the 2 days of the Democrat presidential candidate debates held this past July at the Fox Theater in Detroit, the city and its police force imposed draconian restrictions that prevented anyone with a message that conflicted with the policies of the Democrat candidates, particularly messages that conflicted with the candidates' radical pro-abortion policies, from reaching the debate participants and attendees. As a result, we sued the city and several of its police officers and the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Michigan for silencing the speech of our pro-life clients, Created Equal and its co-founder, Mark Harrington. Indeed, the right to freedom of speech enshrined in the First Amendment is not a right to catharsis. It is a right to meaningfully express one's message in order to influence public opinion and to affect public policy. Not surprisingly, the liberal city of Detroit imposed restrictions that had the intended effect of sanitizing and cleansing the areas immediately in front of and adjacent to the Fox Theater of any messages that were critical of the Democrat presidential candidates and the positions and policies they supported. In particular, these restrictions ensured that our clients' message, specifically including their pro-life signs, would be hidden from the CNN camera shots, the viewers of the debates, the candidates, and those who attended the Fox Theater for the debates. Our Constitution does not permit such treatment. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. You regularly hear us use the phrase the co-responsibility of the laity for the church. This is taken, an address given by Pope Benedict XVI, and it's been used before. Though you can find it in the language of the Church, especially since the Second Vatican Council. But the laity has co-responsibility. We're not just collaborators or cooperators with our clergy. We actually bear co-responsibility for the church with them. And, of course, over the last, we've become very aware of the problems of sexual abuse, issues of sexual harassment, various forms of sexual misconduct, and other problems, financial misdealings. And so we've decided to spend a little more time than we did 15 years ago talking about these problems in order that we might all have a better understanding of how this whole system works. Well, recently in the National Catholic Register, Peter Jesser Smith has penned a piece looking at the St. John's Seminary, which serves the Archdiocese of Boston. And, well, I'll let him characterize what he discovered there. Peter is a reporter for the National Catholic Register, and you can follow him on Twitter at Jesser Smith. That's J-E-S-S-E-R-E-R, Jesser Smith. Peter, good to have you here. Thanks.
Oh, thanks so much. Thanks so much, Al. Appreciate being here. But I should know, I'm familiar with the Boston. I'm familiar with the Boston St. John's Seminary situation, but I haven't written a piece on that recently.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about it, because I know that you are aware of it, and the Register published an editorial, which I assume picked up a lot on the work that you had done. Am I wrong?
Well, yes. I mean, the Boston Seminary situation relates to other investigations that we have done, both for the Christ the King Seminary in Buffalo.
That's right.
And another article that I wrote on this, highlighting the culture of predation that has afflicted a lot of seminaries, involved certain people that had been directly affected by some of the alleged incidents that had happened at the St. John's Seminary.
Yeah. Now, give us the summary of what was the relatively recent flare-up and the reason St. John's, why it was investigated by the ordinary of the archdiocese.
Sure. Well, what had happened with one of the things that had happened in light of McCarrick being named as an abuser, you know, not only of minors but of seminarians, is that last year it started a whole wave of seminarians stepping, many times, unfortunately, ex-seminarians stepping forward and saying, you know, this was my own experience of either Me Too abuse or an experience where, you know, sexual harassment or grooming or other things targeted at them were mishandled and had a lasting impact on their lives and in many ways aborted their vocation. So one of the things that happened is that one of the people who was affected by an anonymous seminarian at St. John's Seminary who had been who's basically one of a number of people that had been sexually stalked by this person, 2015, relayed the fact that to their rector and vice rector that they were receiving these very harassing, sexually graphic texts from somebody that was claiming to be a woman, but basically was trying to basically, you know, entice him into a sexual relationship. And they figured out that this must be a seminarian because this person always knew their class schedule, you know, his identity, you know, their identities, and would never text when they were actually together, when they were actually in class. So anyway, the thing is that he had tried to report this incident, and it wasn't taken seriously enough. But then, furthermore, what happened is that the rector didn't deal with it forcefully. The vice rector was blowing up all the time, and you know, a number of them then felt so alienated, you know, by this, that they were receiving this kind of stalking experience, that they tried to figure it out on their own. That person found out their identities. I mean, that person found out that they were trying to find out who it was. I mean, the whole thing was a huge mess and blew up. But this young man then, you know, he left seminary. In fact, all six of those guys, as far as I know, never completed anything towards priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have one single incident that is really heavily responsible for knocking out the vocations of, you know, six people.
How did this come to the attention of Sean O'Malley?
What happened was this one seminarian posted his experience and what happened on social media, and it got a huge amount of attention. And then Cardinal O'Malley, you know, really wanted to take it seriously, and so started his own investigation. And that actually had a couple of aborted attempts because it became apparent that there's a problem when you're having seminary faculty or people who were originally part of the faculty at one point investigating people who are their friends.
Yep.
Or who were colleagues. And so finally what Cardinal Sean did was he commissioned an independent law firm to do the investigation. And they did a fairly thorough job looking only at a 6-year period from 2012 to 2018 or so, and submitted a detailed 90-page report. So that's what we have. And the report basically goes into say, you know, there's no den of iniquity going on at the seminary, but there are certain areas in which it's really problematic. Guys who really had problems and probably should have been kicked out of the formation program have been ordained, including one guy that was, you know, violating a mother's wishes not to text her teenage girl and was saying, you know, I love you, I miss you, sweetie. I mean,
this is a seminarian.
This was a seminarian. And instead, he was, told on. He was basically passed on to be ordained. But we know from the Pennsylvania grand jury report and from other instances that that's a classic sign of grooming behavior.
Yeah, well.
Now, so this is part of the problems that if – so you see with the seminary that there are serious issues. There are serious faculty and personnel problems. The faculty don't appear to be strongly punished. There wasn't enough oversight.
Yeah.
There was too much trust on the cardinal's part. And so they were strict on kicking out seminarians who had been involved in sexual misconduct.
Yeah.
But they were very lax with enforcing other issues regarding the faculty, in my estimation.
I looked over this, one of the appendices in the report from St. John's Seminary, again, the law firm of Yurko, Salveson, and Rems conducted this study. And one of them, by a Mr. John Monaco, describes how he was really attempted, somebody attempted to seduce him. There was a party where the drinking was way out of control. People were groping one another. I mean, this description of seminary life it leads me to ask the question, what kind of culture was there that seminarians could participate in activities like this without fear of being reprimanded, being disciplined? That's what I don't get, is the absence of you might even say adult responsibility.
Well, yeah, and I think that's a huge. I think that's a huge part of it. Is that it's not just the seminarians; it's the seminary's leadership that's, you know, jumping in and, you know, providing this kind of example, or it's even by their absence. I mean, in the case of St. John's Seminary, the rector was heavily absent. But one of the unfortunate things that happened was when one of the earlier, before the 2014-2015 incidences, one of the faculty had brought this up, and basically the rector said, "I want this guy out." And the cardinal, unfortunately, for whatever prudential judgment he was trying to make, you know, reassigned the faculty member. But the message that it sent to a lot of the seminarians and faculty was, well, if you speak up and you complain, you're going to get, you're going to get punished.
Yeah.
I don't think that was the cardinal's intention, but I mean, there are real lack of accountability mechanisms, and there's bad things built in. Like with the seminary, one of the things that the report pointed out was that the seminary was subsidizing beer. Like, you could purchase a can of beer for a buck or two. The report noted that there's nothing that's been provided here for seminarians who have alcohol dependence or alcohol addiction. So you've created an environment where you're leading people into temptation,
right?
And you're not taking into account their own needs. And this was brought up with the Buffalo Seminary. That yeah. one of the seminarians who left in protest said, you know, I knew guys that were struggling with alcohol, and they were being given alcohol.
Yeah,
you know, and eventually one of them ended up taking the seminary car and driving it through somebody's farmhouse into their living room and got a DUI. But I mean,
yeah.
I mean, what ends up happening is because there's not real actual oversight. There's not enough consequences and accountability for failure.
Even
the world renowned theologian who's a Dominican priest that was teaching there, who was described in detail in this report, being an enormously immature, sexually obsessed, and an all-around divisive, toxic person,
mm-hmm.
He is no longer listed on the faculty page.
Okay.
But it wouldn't take you too long to put together who this person was.
Yeah.
And but again, it's quietly removing people.
And this is, again, not – this is the refusal to tell the story of how things reached this point. And that's what we're missing in all of these discussions. Even when changes are made, nobody bears responsibility for how we got into this mess in the first place. And, well, Peter, I appreciate the work you're doing and hope we can talk again on these things.
Thank you. Absolutely. Keep us in your prayers. We're trying to – you know, we're trying to show the problems that are going on here so that there can be real accountability enforced. But it's got to come. The lay people, especially mothers of seminarians, have got to get in the faces of the bishops and say, we want something done and we want our guys protected.
Yeah. Amen. Thank you so much. We'll talk again, Peter. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, Al.
Peter Jesser Smith, again, we will have the St. John's Seminary report in the Crested Guest Archives there. It's about 90 pages. It's not what you would call light reading. But if you have to read one thing, go read the appendix, which is a social media posting by a Mr. John Monaco. And realize that it was his testimony that finally managed to get some changes underway. But we have to approach these things in the right spirit. But that's going to require knowledge, not just intentions. So this is one way of becoming familiar with how these problems arise and exactly what they are. All right. I'm Al Cresta. More coming up.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
If I discipline consistently, I'd be disciplining constantly. If I were consistent in my discipline, that would mean I would discipline more, and I'd be disciplining him often. The exact opposite is the case. More consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. Why? Because you're predictable. The child knows if he does A, you'll do B.
That is why when you are predictable in your authority, you will actually have to use that authority less. Consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. The more you act when you need to act, the less you will have to act in the future with similar misbehavior.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is Evidences for Christianity. Where do you get information about God? How can you be sure what you read or what you are told by authorities is true? For if the things we are told about Christianity are true, tremendous demands are put upon our lives. And to say we believe them requires that we live them. Elton Trueblood said,
"We should be foolish not to use all the intelligence we can muster in order to try to know whether Christianity is true. To fail to give our minds loyally to this inquiry would not be so much irreverent as stupid."
It's important, therefore, that we get and understand the facts, evidences, and reasons for Christianity. Our life here and for eternity depends on such efforts. To explore more, go to AveMariaRadio.net. Under Resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
Well, thank you very much, and let me remind you that you can follow up on all of our conversations by going to AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net. Go to the Crested Guest Archives there. When we mention books on the program, we try to have them all available in the online bookstore. Again, that's over at AveMariaRadio.net. Make sure you get the app, too. If you're not listening to us on the app, you're missing some real opportunities to stay in touch. Stay with us. We've got another hour coming up. I'm Al Cresta.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We've got another hour talking about the things that matter most. Looking at the history of Turkey is really a cautionary tale for all of us. Before Turkey was invaded by Muslims, it was an ancient Christian region. A large chunk of St. Paul's epistles were sent to or dealt with churches in that area. St. John in the Apocalypse talks about the letters to the seven churches, many of those in the region of what we now call Turkey. And what happened is that Muslim invasions desecrated, destroyed, and turned churches into mosques. We're going to look at the history and where Turkey stands today. Raymond Ibrahim, my guest, has written The Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. He'll be sharing with us his knowledge of what's happened in Turkey. Also coming up this hour, Deacon Stephen Gerdanis, as a film critic, will look at some new movies, The Two Popes, looking at Pope Francis and Pope Benedict in conversation. It's a highly fictionalized version of it, and we'll find out with Stephen. how Stephen evaluates it. Also, we're going to look at a new movie, the story of Franz Jagerstatter. It's called A Hidden Life, directed by Terrence Malick. Jagerstatter is a Catholic who died rather than make a pledge or show allegiance to Hitler. We'll find out what was behind the steely determination of this man. But first, let's get to today's headlines.
Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, December 3rd. It's the memorial of St. Francis Xavier. And today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile. More information on December specials at CharityMobile.com. California Senator Kamala Harris is notifying her staff that she's dropping out of the Democratic race for president. The one-time prosecutor told staff on a conference call that she will release a video soon with the announcement. Harris's campaign was struggling to raise money and rise in the polls of a crowded field. The Pennsylvania Senate is debating a bill that would require a burial or cremation of human remains after miscarriage or abortion. The bill sponsor, Republican Frank Ryan, said that we've wanted to craft something that was voluntary, that provided the family with the ability for closure, the ability to understand that human life was lost. Governor Tom Wolf, a Democrat, has said he would veto the bill if it makes it to his desk. In November, Wolf vetoed a bill that would have banned abortion of children prenatally diagnosed with Down syndrome. He also vetoed in 2017 a bill that would have limited abortions to 20 weeks into pregnancy and banned dilation and evacuation abortions. Similar bills regarding the treatment of fetal remains are being considered in Ohio and on the federal level. The House Intelligence Committee has released its final report on impeachment. The report from the Democratic-led panel says President Trump placed his own personal and political interest above the national interest of the U.S. It alleges that Trump undermined national security in favor of politically motivated investigations aimed at helping his re-election campaign. An early report from Republicans on the committee absolved Trump of wrongdoing. And the President and First Lady Melania Trump are having tea with Prince Charles and his wife in London. That will be followed by a reception with Queen Elizabeth at Buckingham Palace. The President is in London for NATO's 70th anniversary summit. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will host a reception for NATO leaders later today. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. The nation of Turkey continues to play an important role in discussions of America's foreign policy. And it's interesting to remember the history of Turkey. It was once a region that was intensely Christian. A large chunk of St. Paul's epistles were sent to or dealt with its churches. The Apocalypse given to us through St. John also has letters to the churches that were located in the region today that we would call today Turkey. And what happened? When I visited Turkey 2 years ago, Christian churches were unable to, in Istanbul anyways, Christian churches were behind walls and they were unable to mark themselves on the street. So you had to actually know where a church was if you were to go and attend it. You wouldn't know it by just walking down the street. Join me right now to talk a little bit about what happened with Turkey is Raymond Ibrahim. Raymond is the author of Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. He's a Middle East and Islamic specialist. He's also a publisher of the Al-Qaeda Reader. He was born and raised in the United States by Coptic Egyptian parents who themselves were born and raised in the Middle East. He's fluent in English and Arabic, and you can follow his work at RaymondIbrahim.com. Raymond, good to have you back here. Thanks.
Great to be with you again, Al.
Let's talk about Turkey. How intensely Christian was Turkey in ancient times?
Well, as you were saying, all the letters that, or a great chunk of the letters that Paul wrote, including the churches being mentioned, the seven in the Apocalypse, were in Turkey, which was known as Anatolia at the time. Of course, the word, the name Turkey just signifies its Turkification later on, when it was colonized and conquered by the Turks. But it was known as Anatolia, which means the land of the east. And, you know, it was Antioch, one of the oldest seas, of the five seas, along with Rome and the other places, was basically part of Anatolia. It's in Syria now. And it was a very, very, it was part of the Byzantine or the Eastern Roman Empire. In fact, a great many of the Byzantine emperors came from what we would call today Turkey. And it was mostly Greek-speaking, of course. But then the Turks, beginning in the 10th century, but also especially in the 11th century, started coming from the east and slowly invading, you know, starting from the eastern portions, going all the way up until essentially reaching Constantinople. And especially after the Battle of Manzikert in the year 1071, and after that battle where the Turks were victorious, the atrocities that were recorded are mind-boggling, essentially, because the sources talk about literally tens of thousands of people being slaughtered and butchered and hundreds of thousands being hauled off to slavery and churches being destroyed and defiled and so forth. And in fact, that's what actually was a big role, played a big role in the Crusades that Pope Urban called in 1095. It was actually responding to what the Turks were doing in Anatolia, or that is Turkey today. And this just continued on and on until the Ottomans came, basically who were the successor Turkish emirate following the Seljuks. They came and they really upped the jihad. In fact, it's known that the Ottomans, of all the dynasties and sultanates and caliphates throughout history, were the most that were committed to the ideals of jihad, even more than the Arabs.
If
you look at it, they just lived on the principle of jihad, and then they went into, essentially, of course, they conquered Constantinople in 1453, and they went into the Balkans, and all the way up until Vienna, you know, in the year 1683. That's how far they got. And during those years, a lot of people don't know that the Turks, the Ottomans, just the Ottomans alone, enslaved something like 10 million Europeans and sold them in the slave markets from the Balkans. Also, the Crimean Tatars, who were allied and, of course, also Islamic, were you know, in the slave trade of the Slavic peoples and the Russians. That's the forgotten history. You know,
wow.
When you mention the word Turkey, people just think it's always been a Turkish nation. It's not.
Right.
It's colonized slowly, bit by bit, and conquered.
So what happened in so-called modern Turkey with Mustafa Kemal Atatürk?
Well, see, that's very interesting because they went from being the Ottoman Turks went from being the standard bearers of jihad to essentially being the first Islamic power to become very westernized and secularized. And that was a reflection of the Ottoman Empire being beaten essentially by Western powers, during World War One, but also before that. And basically, Turkey just realized the only way it could, you know, keep up with the West was to secularize, that the old way of jihad and so forth and you know, Islamism wasn't cutting it anymore. And so, you know, the Turkish language, for example, was written in the Arabic alphabet, and then that got jettisoned, and they actually adopted the European Latin alphabet, for example.
Huh.
And they also very much secularized and sidelined Islam, and that was a way of basically try to keep step with Europe. But what we're seeing now is a return. So, for instance, Hagia Sophia, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, basilica in Eastern Christendom, was conquered, of course, in Constantinople, as I was saying, 1453, turned into a mosque. But then under Atatürk, it was returned into a museum, or not returned. It was made into a museum, something to be neutral, so it's not a church or a mosque. But now so many Turks, including Erdogan himself, are keen on seeing it returned into a mosque. And, you know, this is, of course, not because there's a dearth of mosques. There isn't. In Istanbul alone, there's something like 3,000 mosques.
Yeah.
But it's just symbolic to underscore the sort of return to a sort of jihadist mentality, a supremacist mentality, you know, and showing that, as I was pointing out, you know, when you look at, whenever a Turk or when the Turks say we want Hagia Sophia, for instance, to become a mosque, and they're commemorating, you know, the man who conquered it, Mehmet or Muhammad II, the Sultan, Ottoman Sultan, they're basically honoring, because if you look at the sources, what really happened, they're honoring, you know, the most ruthless form of jihad. Because if you see what happened when it was conquered, I mean, nuns and women were actually hiding in the Hagia Sophia, and they were systematically raped on the altar. And, you know, very grotesque things happened.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, they want to sort of, it seems so many of them want to relive that sort of Islamic supremacism over the infidel, the, you know, especially the Christian infidel. And that's sort of what I'm seeing in others is happening now in Turkey with this appropriation of ancient churches. A 1,500-year-old church in Turkey, actually, which was a museum during its secular era, they've already announced it's going to become a mosque, and they're actually going to be destroying all the Christian frescoes, these ancient, including images of Christ on the wall and so forth. They're going to wash them to turn it again into essentially a victory mosque. Because as I said, they don't there's no dearth of mosques in Turkey.
Wow.
So this is very symbolic of a sort of, you know, re-Turkification, re-Islamification of ancient Anatolia.
You know, I mentioned that I was in Istanbul about 2 years ago now, and while there, we went to a church, but there are no markings on the outside of the building or on the street to indicate a church was there. It was behind a wall. We had to step back in order to go to Mass. Is that common where Christian churches are not given, you know, freedom of expression?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was a lot more leniency in Turkey in earlier years, again, you know, in accordance with this Mustafa Atatürk secularization. But again, we're seeing this sort of, you know, overall Islamification. And, you know, according to the Islamic laws of Sharia, a church, for example, under Islamic dominion cannot show, display a cross, cannot show any sort of Christian vestiges or symbolism. So that's very much in accordance with, you know, keeping it sidelined and suppressed. And, you know, it's not just, of course, in Turkey. You see this in lots of other Islamic nations.
Do you know the Turkish people's attitude towards this re-Islamization of Turkey? Are they supportive of Erdogan's efforts?
Well, see, that's the thing. You know, there seems like a dichotomy because there's still a lot of very secular Turks who are not supportive of that sort of thing. The thing with Islam and these nations is oftentimes it takes on a nationalist form. So to be a good Turk is to be a good Muslim or to at least, you know, pay lip service. And I think that's what you see a lot with what's going on. So if you want to boost your self-image and your national identity, then you're going to see an uptick in Islamic activism as well. This is why, by the way, you know, a lot of people wonder, a lot of Muslims explain, and there's validity to it, that the reason there is an apostasy law, for example, you know, where you persecute and up to kill a Muslim who, let's say, converts to Christianity, is because he's seen as a traitor, because the national identity of the nation of the Islamic Ummah is Islam. So if you leave it, nobody really cares what you know, what's truth or what's in your heart, but you've become a traitor because our identity is Islamic. So I think that plays a big role in the overall identity of the Turks.
Okay. And so there's no reason to believe that the Turkey leadership under Erdogan is going to reverse that policy. We should assume it will continue to move in the direction of greater Islamization?
Oh, absolutely. Erdogan is, you know, he sees himself as some sort of apparent successor of the Ottoman state, the Ottoman Caliphate, which is, of course, the last caliphate,
right,
sultanate of history, abolished in the, you know, 1920s, unless, of course, you count ISIS, which is the return of another caliphate.
Yeah.
But he's got his hands everywhere. For instance, you know, I was really recently discussing how in Nigeria, there's evidence that he's actually arming Boko Haram, who are fueling, you know, one of the worst, essentially, jihads against Christians of Nigeria.
Yep.
And there's evidence of that. And, of course, we saw the ISIS and jihadists who were, you know, right on the Turkish border, which raises a lot of questions. But and he's actually built mosques all around the Islamic world, including West Africa and so forth, which, again, is, you know, his bona fides of being a good Islamic leader.
Mm-hmm.
So he definitely is trying to relive and bring back the past. And most recently, you know, history is repeating itself. I saw he was threatening Greece, especially with, you know, unleashing, you know, all these, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of migrants into Europe through Greece and so forth. And, you know, as observers note, it's once again, here's Turkey threatening its Greek neighbors, who, of course, its land it stole and appropriated.
Right.
As we were saying, Turkey itself was a portion of Greece.
Yeah. Well,
so he's definitely on the war path in many ways.
Now, we're out of time, unfortunately, Raymond. How do people stay in touch with your work?
Well, thanks, Al. Best way just to go to my website. Also, I'm in social media. Look up my name, Raymond Ibrahim, and website, RaymondIbrahim.com.
Very good. Again, RaymondIbrahim.com. We'll have it linked at our site as well. And Raymond's outstanding book, The Sword and the Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West, is available in our online bookstore.
What qualifies as a valid marriage in the eyes of the Catholic Church? The Catechism tells us there are certain requirements that must be present or the marriage is not a true sacrament. The requirements are as follows. The marriage must be between a baptized man and a baptized woman who are free to contract marriage and who freely express their consent. The Catechism defines freedom to contract as not being under constraint and not impeded by any natural or ecclesiastical law. The exchange of consent between the spouses is considered by the Church to be the most indispensable element of a valid marriage. According to the Catechism, the consent must be an act of the will of each party, free of coercion or grave external fear. If this freedom is lacking, the marriage is not valid. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is the logic of Catholicism. Solanus Casey said, "Appreciation is as necessary for social order and harmony as are the laws of gravity for the physical world." Critics of the Church often boast, "What good is the Church anyway? Science can tell us everything we need to know." Okay, fine. Ignore the Church's moral teachings. Why is it then that after centuries of study, social and biological scientists tell us that among observant Christians, there is less crime, disease, and suicide, and higher levels of charity, service, and happiness? The reason is that for millennia, through God's revelation, Catholic precepts have provided shortcuts to understanding what is good, true, and beautiful. Today, share with your friends your appreciation for the Church's shortcuts to the good life. And that's the logic of Catholicism. Explore more at AveMariaRadio.net. Under resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
I was raised a Catholic and went to church every Sunday faithfully. I met a boy and he was non-Catholic, so I left the church to be with him. When I was away from church, I yearned to be home. What brought me back was my longing for the Eucharist. The Eucharist fills me with a spirit that you can't find anywhere else. I have a peace when I walk through the doors of the Catholic Church, like that's where I belong.
We invite you to take another look at the Catholic Church. Visit CatholicsComeHome.org today.
You need courage to stand up and be Christian, and stand up and be a real Catholic, not a divided Catholic.
Mother Angelica courageously evangelized the world. One of the first ways she evangelized was through small books full of powerful messages. You can have all of Mother's beloved mini books in one complete collection in The Spiritual Wisdom of Mother Angelica from EWTN Publishing, now available at EWTNRC.com.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. We are now into Advent, and also there's no forgetting that Christmas comes at the close of Advent. And so we also then think, of course, of Christmas vacation and we think of movies. There's a lot of movie watching that goes on in Christmas, between Christmas and New Year's. And I wanted to spend some time with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, creator of DecentFilms.com and a film critic for the National Catholic Register, to talk a little bit about Christmas viewing films, Advent viewing films, keep the focus on Advent. But before we go there, I have a question about a new film coming out called The Two Popes. Stephen, great to have you back here again. Thanks.
Oh, it's good to be here.
The Two Popes, you got Anthony Hopkins in this. And what is going on with this movie?
So the idea of having two individuals who are both, in some sense, the Pope, or who have papal status in some way, at the same time, at the time of the retirement of Benedict XVI, really captured the world's imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And screenwriter Anthony McCartan, who's also a playwright, wrote a stage play called The Pope. His initial idea was about the idea of these two popes kind of coexisting and what that was like. But he very quickly turned it into a story about Benedict's papacy and about his thoughts about retirement and the contrast that he foresaw foreseen at that time between Benedict and Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio, the current Pope Francis, if Bergoglio were the one to replace him.
Okay. Now, is this drawing from a novel or something?
No, not a novel. He did some historical research, and he wrote a nonfiction book called The Two Popes that, as far as I've been able to tell, covers the history, at least, you know, in terms of the facts that I've checked. It's okay. Pretty responsible and accurate. The stage play, The Pope, and now this drama film, The Two Popes, is very heavily fictionalized. So
okay.
There are conversations between Pope Benedict and Bergoglio, Cardinal Bergoglio, that never happened, and certainly the tension and the conflict between them is very heavily fictionalized.
Okay, so there is a nonfiction book dealing with this theme of two popes.
Yeah, and it's pretty funny because when you look at the nonfiction book, it actually corrects the record and refutes a lot of the things that are wrong with the film.
Oh my word! I wonder what that's about. The same play.
Know,
I mean, he's the writer of the nonfiction book is also the screenwriter for the stage play, The Pope. And
That's right.
Okay. Did he also do the script for Two Popes?
Yes. Yeah. It's
the same guy.
Paul McCartan, and so it's kind of weird. Like people who watch this movie, which is on Netflix now.
Okay.
Or it's coming. Has it debuted on Netflix? I think it has.
It may have. I haven't seen it though. But go ahead.
So it stars Jonathan Pryce as Bergoglio, the future Pope Francis, and
okay.
people were saying as soon as he became Pope that Jonathan Pryce would be a good choice to pick to play him because there is a physical resemblance much more than with Anthony Hopkins and Cardinal Ratzinger,
yeah.
A.K.A. Benedict XVI.
Yeah.
But the film really presents this kind of stereotyped image of Pope Benedict as very conservative, even arch-conservative. He's against any kind of change whatsoever. And then Bergoglio is this very liberal reformer who tries to resign early. Benedict is worried that this is some kind of protest against the conservatism of his papacy, and he refuses to accept the resignation. This is all nonsense, and if you read McCartan's own book, he states that when Bergoglio turned in his resignation in 2011, he was 75. It was the mandatory age of retirement
right.
required by canon law.
Yeah.
So this whole idea of a protest, which dominates the first act of the film, is complete fiction.
I wonder why. Is it just too hard? Do you have to have this kind of foil between the two popes in order to make it interesting? I just don't understand how he – I mean, it sounds as though he hadn't has never read anything written by Ratzinger, Benedict, or Bergoglio, and yet we know he has because he wrote the nonfiction book. So I don't get it.
It is puzzling, and I think it's more a thesis about the idea of a conservative church versus the idea of a progressive church. And these two popes are just kind of convenient icons for these ideas.
Gotcha.
And for what it's worth, if you look at the characters symbolically, you know, I have certainly experienced people who hold ideas like the ones that we hear from these two popes, but they're just not the pope's ideas.
Right, right. No, I get it. I certainly understand that dynamic. I mean, you write in your review that there's a point, there's an unendurably shrill quarrel around the 30-minute mark that ends with Benedict snapping, "I don't agree with anything you say," which is so uncharacteristic of Joseph Ratzinger. So I
was so stressed at that point in the film that I actually took a moment to go out to Twitter, and I tweeted 30 minutes into the two popes that I don't know how much more I could take.
Okay. All right. So I'm trying to think, what redeems this thing? Is there any redemptive value to this film?
It's certainly interesting to watch these two pros act against each other.
If you think of them as embodying these ideas, if you think of them as kind of vehicles for two contrasting views, kind of idealized views of the conservative versus the progressive, is that the way to look at this?
You could say that, but even then you have to deal with the fact that the movie is entirely on the side of liberalization. Benedict's saving grace in the film's eyes is that he recognizes that God has rejected his vision of the church and that he wants the progressivism of Francis. So I can't really, even though not every minute of this film is as unendurable as that argument, I can't recommend the two popes in any way, shape, or form.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the things that you can recommend about Advent viewing and Christmas viewing. First of all, are you aware of any new films during this season that people should be excited about?
Well, one of the things that I like to do, particularly for Advent, is to watch films about saints and Beati. And there is a very exciting film that's opening soon by Terrence Malick, the director of
Tree of Life.
The Tree of Life is well known to many of our listeners. And the film is called A Hidden Life. It's a historical biographical film about a beatus that is not known to many. He was beatified by Cardinal Ratzinger, and his name is Franz Jägerstätter.
I'm familiar with him. Oh, yes. I've done a little bit of reading on him. Yeah.
So he was arrested at the start of World War II because he was willing to serve in some capacity. He was willing to be a medic or to do some other thing. But the requirement that he couldn't get past, and so this kind of ties him to Thomas More, is that all members of the German military were required to swear a personal oath of allegiance, of loyalty, to Adolf Hitler.
Yep.
And he couldn't do that.
Right.
So he was arrested. He was tortured. He spent a number of years in prison. And this kind of connected to Sophie Scholl in 1943, when Germany was getting into the sham trials phase of its propaganda war, and people were getting their heads cut off. He was one of the victims of that.
Wow. Yeah,
he has been declared a martyr, and he is now a blessed.
Yeah, he's a remarkable figure, and again, he was not really. He doesn't really begin to get a lot of public attention until the 1960s, I think, when there's a biography written of him by Gordon Zahn, left-leaning sociologist, and then Thomas Merton did a chapter on him in the book Faith and Violence. So this is a heroic figure that we need to know more about. Have you seen the film then?
Oh, I have. It's absolutely beautiful. I'm an admirer of Malick's style.
Yeah.
I haven't connected as powerfully with any of his films yet as I've always wanted to, and I kind of feel like this is really the film where it all comes together for me. Mm. He's interacting with two of my favorite films in some way. I mentioned them, A Man for All Seasons and Sophie Scholl, The Final Days. But he does something that neither of those films do, which is to combine this history and this very moving testimony of a life with an absolutely gorgeous and poetic cinematic style. It's a long film. It's over 3 hours long.
Wow.
And you really lose yourself in the visual poetry and in the just the rhythms of this man's life. First, his kind of idyllic life with his wife living up in the mountains as farmers, and then the fall from grace, which is a kind of recurring theme in many of Malick's films.
Well, this is remarkable. Tell me a little bit about, does the film portray his wife very well? I mean, is she an essential part of the portrayal of his life?
Yes, absolutely. Their relationship is at the heart of the film. I don't know the actress, Valerie Pachner, who plays Franziska. Franz Jägerstätter himself is played by August Diehl, who of course I do know. So it's really like other films of his, like The New World, for instance, in the relationship between Pocahontas and... Oh, the Christian Bale character, I'm blanking on his name. Marriage is at the center of this film. It's really about the marital union. You could almost say it's a kind of a theology of the body in cinema.
Wow.
Their physical intimacy, their closeness shown in embraces. It's a wonderful, beautiful film.
Okay, well, that again is called Hidden Life, directed by Terrence Malick. Can you stay with me in another segment, Steve?
Yeah, sure.
Great. We're going to continue talking with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, taking a look at some of the great films available during this Advent and then Christmas season, and we'll also look back at some of the great ones.
Would you get on a plane that doesn't have a pilot? Investing in passive index mutual funds may present the same issue. The Ave Maria Mutual Funds are actively managed by seasoned investment professionals to help you meet your investment goals in a morally responsible way. Ave Maria funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors could invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Fund. You can learn more about the Ave Maria Mutual Funds at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com. This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 10 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan cost goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
The EWTN home video highlight for December is the EWTN Family Christmas Special. The Choir of the Eternal Word Television Network performs classical Christmas carols with a special commentary by Father Joseph Mary Wolfe. Order your DVD or CD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. The Catholic faith has enemies. We're Catholics. We have enemies. They are a danger to the faith. And yet we're called to defend the faith, to instruct the ignorant, and to love our enemies. These enemies abuse divine revelation. They abuse science and religion. They abuse our history and our past. They abuse power and wealth. We have to learn how to deal with our enemies by picking up a copy of my book, Dangers to the Faith. You can find it online at AveMariaRadio.net.
We recently filed a civil rights lawsuit in federal court in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Oklahoma against the city of Tulsa and its chief of police for unlawfully firing one of its police officers because local political activists complained to the city about conservative social media posts the officer had made several years prior to his hiring as a Tulsa police officer. In a cowardly act of political correctness, the city of Tulsa and its chief of police fired a good officer because local left-wing political activists complained about certain Facebook posts allegedly made by our client 3 to 6 years prior to his hiring as a police officer. These activists play the race and anti-Islam cards every chance they get because, quite frankly, they hate white, conservative Christian police officers. It's a shame that the Tulsa police leadership was so willing to throw the officer under the bus to appease these radicals. While the Tulsa leadership might side with these anti-police activists, I can assure you that the rank and file do not. As set forth in the lawsuit, it is well settled that the government cannot condition public employment on a basis that infringes the employee's constitutionally protected interest in freedom of expression. Our lawsuit alleges that the city's firing of the officer violated his rights protected by the First and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. We are seeking damages and attorney's fees. I'm Robert Use, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at avemariaradio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to avemariaradio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. With me is Stephen Gradonis, film critic. And you can follow his work, by the way, at decentfilms.com. Talked last segment about a movie called The Two Popes, which pits Cardinal Benedict against, Pope Benedict against Pope Francis. Not worthy of our time, but there's another film that is out this year called Hidden Life, and it is, from Stephen's review of it, a remarkable portrayal of the solitary and sacrificial witness of Blessed Franz Jagerstatter. And I haven't seen it. I'm looking forward to it. I know a little bit about the man's history. I just came across it about 6 months ago, maybe even reading that the film was in production, but I don't remember where I first heard about it. But it's called A Hidden Life. Let's talk, is there anything else coming up this season, new material coming up this season that you're excited about?
If listeners are fans of The Godfather and of the gangster cinema of Martin Scorsese,
yeah,
I want to highly recommend another movie that's over 3 hours long.
The Irishman.
The Irishman.
I just saw it. Yeah. I just saw it.
Yes. You did. Okay.
Yeah. I enjoyed it.
So, yeah. It's. I mean, the first, I would say, two and a half hours is fairly conventional gangster drama. But in the last hour, The Irishman really comes into a kind of artistic and moral focus.
Right. Right.
Like I've never seen in this genre before, and especially in the last half hour, and then again, even in the last 10 minutes and the very last shot.
Right.
It's really extraordinary.
Yeah. I just stumbled across it, and I thought, Scorsese is making a movie for Netflix? I mean, wow, that's saying something. And then I looked at the cast, and I said, this has got to be a serious piece of work.
It is, and unfortunately what it's saying is that, you know, in Hollywood right now, the major studios, no one was willing to bankroll this, but Netflix, which is trying to compete with Disney Plus and Amazon Prime and
right.
all the rest of it, for them,
right.
you know, this is right up their alley, and the fact that it's so long means that it's a movie that does work well on the big screen.
Yeah.
So the film is about the murder of Jimmy Hoffa, And it's told through the eyes of a man named Frank Sheeran, who was a hitman and a driver, mm-hmm. Who moved in Hoffa circles. Frank Sheeran is played by Robert De Niro. Hoffa is played by Al Pacino. And they use the same kind of de-aging digital effect that we've seen in Marvel movies to make Pacino and De Niro look younger. It's sometimes successful and sometimes not.
Yeah.
But for me, the really powerful part comes toward the end. As our protagonist, the man in whose head we've spent the whole movie, as he kind of regales us with the tales of his youth from the nursing home where he's living now, mm-hmm. as he begins to realize that he has nothing left in life, that everyone that he ever cared about is gone. He's completely alienated from his family, and in particular from his daughters, who are kind of silent moral witnesses of his failures and of the horrible way that he's lived his life. And in the end, the movie makes it clear that there comes a point in your life where no matter how bad a life you've lived, the idea of connecting with God comes back to you. But is it possible? Is it possible after living that life? Do you know how to do it? And that's really demonstrated in a very poignant way.
He's haunted throughout the movie, especially as it moves along, by moral decision-making. What is he willing to do to survive? And then eventually, what is he willing to do to thrive? And I don't want to give too much away, but this is a fellow who is always brought to the brink of repentance, he's not personally very articulate, but the movie is.
No.
The movie is very articulate.
It really is.
Yeah.
And when you get to the end, I want you, as you're watching the final shot, I want you to think of the last shot of The Godfather. Because The Godfather ends with that famous closing door as Michael Corleone's wife watches and realizes that she's shut out of his life, that there's the inner life and the outer life. And the priests in The Godfather are part of that outer life. They're shut out. They'll do your sacraments. They'll baptize their babies. But they have no moral influence. They have no ability to redeem your soul. That's the world of The Godfather. In this movie, there's also a door, and what it means for that door to be shut or open says everything about the state of the soul of Frank Sheeran and the way that he's caught between despair and his desire to hope without even really knowing how.
Yeah, Sheeran's also written a book. He wrote a book on the execution of Hoffa. I won't say too much more than that, but it's also based on Sheeran's book. So,
yes. So it's one story of what may have happened
to
Jimmy Hoffa.
That's the way to put it. That's good. I'm glad you saw it. I like I said, I just stumbled across it, and I love to be surprised. And I was really delighted by this. In fact, I'm going to watch it again with my 27-year-old son, who's involved in film. So what else can we talk about this season?
In terms of what's new this season, those are the things that I'm most excited about.
Okay.
Of course, this is also a time when we refocus and look back at Worthwhile Fare in the past.
Yep.
It's a season of traditional movies, whatever is your holiday viewing tradition. There are certain movies that as families, as individuals, we go back to and we watch over and over every year. For some of us, those are the TV specials, A Charlie Brown Christmas above all, but also the 1966 How the Grinch Stole Christmas, mm-hmm. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. There are the Christmas movies that you can't get away from. There's the classic Home Alone. Mm-hmm. There's the Tim Allen Santa Claus movies, which I'm not a fan of.
Mm-hmm.
Elf, which I actually am a fan of, in spite of not being a fan in general of Will Ferrell. I think he's really endearing in Elf.
I agree. That's interesting. That's not one of my favorite guys either, but I do like the movie Elf. Yeah. It's a Wonderful Life, of course.
Of course, the best.
Yeah, I agree. and I'm looking here at Home Alone. Netflix also started this series called The Movies That Made Us, and they've got their hour presentations, that look at the personalities, and sometimes the machinations behind the making of these iconic movies, memorable movies. Home Alone, they've done Home Alone, and it was interesting to see the intention of the filmmaker, the director in Home Alone, whose name slipped. Oh, Chris Columbus, I think, was the director for that.
Yes.
And what he loves Christmas movies, and he was very big on ensuring that there was those transcendent moments in the church with the choir and the encounter between Macaulay Culkin and the old man. And I it goes to show you again that there are many people out in the world who you may not think have spiritual sensitivities, but in fact they do. And I don't know anything about Chris Columbus's life, but he certainly in Home Alone was trying to do more than just tell a rollicking children's story. So,
and that film really has touched so many people, not only here in the United States, but across the world. I was listening to an interview on the radio with Joe Pesci, who plays one of the bad guys.
Oh, yes, yes.
And of course, he's also in The Irishman. He plays the mobster that Frank Sheeran works for. And he's a pivotal character, and Pesci gives a very unexpected performance in that role. But Pesci was talking about how, even when he travels abroad, people recognize him and they come up to him. And they know him from Home Alone.
that's fascinating. Man for All Seasons is also a good Christmas movie, even though it's not normally associated with Christmas. What do you like? You don't like the Tim Allen things. I haven't cared for those either. Mentioned It's a Wonderful Life. Did you like The Bishop's Wife with Cary Grant, the old film?
Yeah. So I do have some Scrooge-like opinions on some of these holiday classics.
Go ahead.
The Tim Allen films really suffer for me from what I have called post-marital snark. There's this kind of broken family film syndrome in them, the character's bitterness over the divorce from the wife. And it doesn't get better in the subsequent movies when we're supposed to accept it as normal. I have very strong feelings about how angels are portrayed in cinema.
Yeah.
And I'm very allergic to the idea of angels as kind of outside the human experience, looking in and almost wanting to be one of us. So this is the premise of Wim Wenders' classic Wings of Desire, which was remade into the Nicolas Cage movie City of Angels.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's a bad film. It's not really about angels. It's about the city of Berlin, and it's about a kind of a psychological condition that you could call angelism. But I've always wanted to see angels portrayed in a way that gives them their own authentic existence and dignity separate from human life. And neither the Bishop's Wife with Cary Grant nor the remake with Denzel Washington, The Preacher's Wife, really does that for me.
Mm-hmm.
There's very little true Christmas sentiment in either of these films. And if a movie is about a bishop trying to write a homily for Christmas, I think that there should be a little bit more of the real meaning of Christmas in that story than you get from either of these films.
Yeah, no, very good. Very good. We've got Lives of Jesus, a lot of greatest story never told, Zeffirelli's Jesus of Nazareth. Which of the Jesus cinema productions do you like?
I always recommend the first 100 plus minutes of Jesus of Nazareth as my favorite Christmas viewing.
Yeah.
I've never seen a telling of the birth of Jesus and the nativity that does a better job of putting it into theological context and historical context than the first 100 minutes or so of Zeffirelli's Jesus of Nazareth. More broadly, I am a huge fan, and I can never stop singing the praises of one of the best researched and most theologically and historically literate Jesus movies ever made, an animated cartoon, a stop-motion film called The Miracle Maker, which was made in 2000. It's complex and sophisticated enough for theologians and scripture scholars, but it's simple enough to watch with young children. The Miracle Maker, it's almost the perfect Jesus movie. It's really, really worth your time. Don't be put off if you're not a fan of cartoons. Don't think, oh, this is for the kids.
There was a
much more than that.
There was a movie a few years ago. What was it called? Was it Mary of Nazareth? The focus was on Mary, and that has seemed disappeared. I don't know what happened to it, but I haven't heard anybody mention it for a while.
It's still out there, and a lot of people really like it. I'm not a huge fan, but there's nothing really wrong with it.
All right. Stephen, thanks once again, and we'll talk.
Thank you, Al.
All right. Deacon Stephen Gradonis at decentfilms.com. I'm Al Cresta.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John 6, verses 48 to 58. Jesus says, "I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, and they died. This is the bread," meaning me. "This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that a man may eat of it and never die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my flesh." At which the Jews disputed among themselves, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" They're scandalized by this. How is it that we're not? How is it that we just hear this and go, "Oh yeah, I know that passage"? They're just outraged and at least perplexed. Sane people, inspired teachers, wise men, prophets don't say things like this.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
To vent or not? If I get it off my chest, then I feel better. I've got to vent. Is this so? It's old theory. Somewhat like a catharsis. You've got to purge yourself of these emotions, and Lord help anyone who's standing in the way. It's old theory. It's inaccurate. Venting is generally not good for the hearers, and it's not good for the venter. Venting may be good for dryers. It's not good for people. When we vent, we become more likely to vent. And when we are more likely to vent, we are more likely to hurt and say things we shouldn't say. Careful on the venting. Better to think about what you have to say before you vent.
Well, thanks so much. Good being with you. And I need to remind you that as we go off the air, Catholic Answers Live continues. And Tim Staples hosting an open forum, so be ready with your questions. He's certainly ready with the answers. We're going to spend time preparing for tomorrow's program, where we'll be talking with Dr. Rick Fitzgibbons about habits for a healthy marriage. And there are many challenges, of course, to marriage in the world today, the breakdown of the family, the me-first mentality of the culture, widespread availability of pornography. And Rick does a great job helping to remind us of the importance of the family and also how we can build families that are impervious to those to cultural decay, you might put it. So thanks for being with me today, and I should remind you that you can follow up on any of our conversations by going to AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net, checking out the online bookstore as well as the Cresta Guest Archives. I'll see you tomorrow.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.